So I'm sitting here with Michelle of Align Rehabilitation, and she is really growing and has something coming up on May 3rd.
On May 3rd, Align Rehabilitation will be having our grand opening of our brand new physical therapy facility. We are directly next door to Real Life Prosthetics, who has also expanded their lab as they build out their prostheses. So May 3rd is grand opening. I invite everyone to come tour both my brand new facility for physical therapy treatment, as well as see what Real Life Prosthetics has done with their new lab.
And what time is it?
It's 11 to 2, and then the ribbon cutting is at 11:15.
And so what's the address?
The address is 3435 Box Hill Corporate Center Drive, Suite C, Abingdon, Maryland, 21009.
Experience a treasure straight from the Caribbean. It's called Island Spice, right off I-95 at exit 77. Island Spice is beautifully decorated. Try the Rasta Pasta, Jerk Chicken, Curry Chicken, Roti, Oxtails, or Goat Too. Sit in the stylish lounge for happy hour drinks from 4 to 7 daily. Check out their complete menu at IslandSpiceJamaicaRestaurant.com or follow us on Facebook for upcoming events like reggae, karaoke, live jazz, and paint night too.
Island Spice, make you lick your finger, man.
My name is Rich Bennett, and on this episode of Harford County Living, Lyle Garrity and I sat down with members of the Harford County Health Department, and we talked about plan review and food inspections and food safety for restaurants, food trucks, even temporary licensing for, say, setting up a pit beef or a barbecue bash or something like that. A lot of very good information, so sit back and enjoy, and if you have any questions, reach out and contact the Harford County Health Department.
You are listening to the Harford County Living Podcast with Rich Bennett. Thank you for coming, and please send any suggestions or comments to podcast@harfordcountyliving.com. The Harford County Living Podcast is produced for your enjoyment, and show notes can be found at harfordcountyliving.com. Come back often and feel free to add the podcast to your favorites, RSS feed, or iTunes. All links are in the show notes. Now let's join Rich Bennett and his special guest.
Sitting here at the health department again, this time with, and if I get it wrong, just throw something at me, food services facility plan review, right?
Mm-hmm. That would be my division.
Yes. And the food service facility routine inspection.
Division. Okay. First, tell us what you guys, Justin, we'll start with you. What is it that you actually do?
Okay, so my official title is the program supervisor for the Division of Food Plan Review.
That's your title?
That's the title. That's the new title, right. So what I do in our capacity, there's two of us in my division. Anybody who wants to open a retail food service facility in Harford County has to come through our department. So one good example would be a brand new restaurant. So if a new restaurant wants to come to our county, they have to apply for building permits. They have to submit a set of plans to our division, with equipment cut sheets or spec sheets for every piece of equipment that's going to go in that restaurant. So we review all of this information, and then we approve a building permit. That's it in a nutshell.
So basically any facility that, not just restaurants, I guess, any facility that's making food, whether any, it be candy or...
Well, not necessarily. Any place that's going to serve potentially hazardous food, food that needs to be either refrigerated or food that's open and served. So if you're just serving Snicker bars, Kit Kats, and bottled water, we don't license you.
Really?
Right. You can sell that without a food license from a county or a state agency. But if you're gonna have like milk or cheese or something that requires refrigeration to control the growth of bacteria, or if you're even gonna have open food, like a hot dog roller at a 7-Eleven, for example, those are foods that have to be controlled by time and or temperature. So then we would license you. But we don't license the sale of retail non-potentially hazardous foods, water, right. candy, chips, stuff like that.
So
prepackaged. So they have to be commercially prepackaged. Once those non-potentially hazardous foods are opened and served, then we would license you.
Now, what about your... All right, because you said any facilities here in the county.
That's right.
Even the, I guess you could say, the roving ones, you know, like the food trucks?
Yes, that's considered another food license. They're just on wheels. So we treat them exactly the same. There's a few different restrictions that they have regarding plumbing because they're not connected directly into the plumbing system. They have a contained self-enclosed plumbing system, but all the other food handling processes, procedures, regulations are all identical, pertain the same to them as well.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, I was wondering about that because with restaurants, I know if they're serving food, they have to have restrooms, right?
Mm-hmm.
How does that work with food trucks, though?
Well, that's a good question. So right now, there is nothing in the regulation or in COMAR, is our food regulations 10-15-03. There's nothing that says that the operators of a food truck have to have access to a bathroom on board. They just have to have access to one in either close proximity. I don't know the exact words of what it says, but they, if they need to use the restroom, they are on wheels and they can travel to the nearest public restroom to okay. use that. They do have to have hand washing right. on site. So some people might say, oh, they don't have a bathroom. You know, how could you wash your hands? Well, they do have to have adequate hand washing in place on their truck. But if they need to use the bathroom, they'll park their truck, lock it up, and walk across the street to a public restroom or drive to an area that has a restroom and use it. And then when they board their truck again, they would have to go through the hand washing process.
Are you saying hand washing, but what about their, you know, as far as equipment and utensils? Does that fall under hand washing too?
Well, on the truck. So, you know, when we said that the food trucks have the exact same regulations as a mm-hmm. as a standalone brick and mortar restaurant, the food truck also has to be equipped with a 3-compartment sink for washing your okay. utensils. So it's going to be 3 sinks to wash, rinse, and sanitize, as well as an additional 4th sink to wash specifically just their hands. So they don't escape any of those regulations. Everything is washed, rinsed, and sanitized, including their hands on that mobile unit.
Okay. Now, and I don't know if you could answer this or if this would be for Michael. Like pit beef. You used to see people with pit beef doing them all the time. Now, my understanding is that that has changed because now they have to be affiliated with a restaurant. Or, I mean, how's that work? If I want to just go out and start selling pit beef on the street corner.
So, Well, right now, because this is sort of still a plan review,
okay.
and then maybe Mike can tail in towards the end of it, but if you just want to set up an open food stand, whether it's pit mm-hmm. beef, pit turkey, or whatever, you can't do that unless it's in conjunction with a public event. At that point, you have to file for a temporary food permit.
Like the barbecue bash.
Barbecue bash. Okay. Exactly. If you want to design an enclosed mobile unit that has 4 walls and a ceiling and a hood system and the hand washing, you can probably have someone extend a mobile unit that has a pit beef stand that's attached to the back of it, but we wouldn't allow you to leave the mobile unit and have a separate pit beef stand outside of the mobile unit, if that makes any sense. You can't set up a pit beef stand with open food and food handling processes away from a licensed mobile unit. So if you did want to go on the side of the street and just sell pit beef to make mm-hmm. a profit or whatever, it would have to be in the confines of an enclosed mobile unit that we license.
Interesting.
So you would have some people.
So you can't tow the grill behind it.
You can't tow.
Some people are non-regulation. Yeah. Like,
right.
Well, that's true. You may come across various people. You're driving. You see somebody selling pit beef.
Yeah.
Just because. Well, they probably shouldn't be doing that. They're not licensed to do that. And we should probably know about it. So we can stop it.
We haven't done that.
Right, right.
I'm glad you told me that.
We've come across mobile units that were operating they shouldn't have. We go there and we shut them down. But no, to answer your question, you can't just set up on the side of a road and sell pit beef.
Yeah, similar to the operation we had last year at the Pet Fest. The guy had his truck, but his barbecue was built into the truck.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
or the trailer, rather.
It'd be nice if we could afford something like that.
Yeah, huh? It would.
Rich's so, hippie stand coming right. to you.
So if we set up, as the Lions Club, as a nonprofit, we set up at a community event mm-hmm. to sell chili or pit beef or whatever, we just need the temporary food permit for the day.
Right.
And how did the regulations, and I've looked at some of this online, but with respect to washing hands and cleaning dishes and utensils, I mean, it could be as simple as having 3 or 4 5-gallon buckets, but does that suffice, or do you need something more than that?
For a temporary food service license, the 3 clean basins, like you might line the kitchen sink with, or the 3 clean buckets would suffice. But for his mobile unit setting, they're subject to the regular food service facility regulations, so they couldn't just have 3 portable buckets
right,
or 3 basins. But in a temporary setting, under a temporary license, some things are certainly not as stringent. So you could use that kind of setup for the ware washing, not for the hand sink. Yeah, hand sink, you would set up a portable hand wash station. Ware washing, that would be a portable ware washing operation.
Right.
With 3 basins, similar to what would be required in a mobile unit. Just that it would need to be like built in and not portable and makeshift in the mobile unit because it's ongoing. It's doing it every day, every week, for a period of time, up to a year. Their license is good for
oh, really?
Yeah, their license up good to good for up to a year. Temporary is good up to 14 days, up to 2 weeks. Generally, people okay. call them a 1-day temporary permit, but it's good up to 14 days for the event. The event can be that long.
Hmm. Works for us.
Yeah, really. Yeah. You mentioned before we started recording something about food complaints, I guess, from restaurants. Mm-hmm. And even food complaints on Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How do you guys weed that out? Because, I mean, do you handle that, first of all?
Well, Michael's division handles it more than I do. So I'll let him speak on that. But I don't know if we're the ones that weed out, because we get a lot of our complaints and information from Molly's office, but you would handle most of those complaints?
Yes, so they would come into our division, often by way of Molly's division. She would pass them on to us. And I guess shortest answer is that we would be responsible for investigating them all. So even though some might sound far-fetched, we're still required,
okay.
if it's possible, to, I guess, do what the complaint says, alleges what's done, then we would investigate it.
I was wondering about that, because, you know, people will put false complaints out there.
This just is true.
If they get mad. Yeah. We get some of those, too. But people also send in pictures, and then you're like, ooh. Like, but some of them are just like, this doesn't look... You know, this doesn't look like
right.
something that would require inspection, but your requirements are different than, like, you wouldn't, if you got a picture of, like, gunk on a table, you wouldn't necessarily, I mean, you would have to go follow up with them, but that wouldn't require, usually, some sort of inspection or...
In order to investigate it, it would require a visit,
right?
And then we would go from there. We would look at what the complainant alleges occurred and try to see, verify if that did occur, is still occurring, or maybe not likely to have occurred at all.
What do you feel like the most common thing for a food inspection?
Food inspection?
Mm-hmm.
That's out of compliance?
Yes.
In full-service restaurants, it would be a failure to cool food properly.
Temperature control.
Yes, and cooling, in the cooling steps or cooling process. Most people or facilities can cook food just fine, or they do cook food just fine. They don't have any problems conducting that adequately. They generally can hot hold food just fine, but many more places... percentage-wise, fail in cooling food properly. I guess it just doesn't register. It's not as natural a thought process
right.
that food is also in a danger zone when it's cooling. as well as cooling is just as important as cooking the food to a good temperature. Cooling back down to a safe temperature is just as important.
Cooling it before you put it in the refrigerator?
No, cooling including being in the refrigerator.
Now that's one mistake, kind of like what you were mentioning. Some people think that you have to cool it down before you put it in the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that we come across that people are not cooling properly is they'll cook maybe 2-3 gallons of like a beef stew or something. They want to, then it's really hot. They put it on their counter. They want to let it cool before they put it in the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And that's not really the proper way to do it.
Really?
Right. So you want to make sure... The best thing to do is to drop the temperature of any food that you plan on cold holding as quickly as possible. We have some time and temperature time frames to guide by, but the idea is to not ever let anything sit out at room temperature or within the danger zone. So you have some allotted time. If you have soup at 200 degrees, we don't expect you to just put it in the refrigerator to cool it.
Right.
But once that soup or whatever it is you're cooling drops down to about 135 degrees, now at that 135 degree mark, you have to start your cooling process, whether it's breaking down into smaller containers, increasing the surface area, putting it into different pots that are not the ones that you cooked in, but a cooler pot. And then you then put them in the refrigerator or freezer uncovered, protected. You know, you don't want to put it underneath something, but you want to put it on an upper shelf uncovered and really draw out all that hot temperature to cool it to 41 or lower within 6 hours. And then what is it? 135 to 70 within the first 2 hours. And then from 70 to 41 in the remaining 4 hours. So that's the idea.
So a timer, I guess the gist of that is that the timer starts at the 135. So you cook the soup, it's on the stove, it comes off at 200. 205, what have you. It is okay to leave that soup on the counter at 200 and 190 and 170. But at the point in time that it gets down to 135, that's where the danger zone for food and bacterial growth begins. And at that point, it needs to start cooling rapidly. So you probably don't want to... If you put that hot soup, 135 degree soup, in the refrigerator, it needs to be broken down into small units that a refrigerator can cool in a short amount of time without overpowering that refrigerator, making everything in there warm. And now nothing's cold or cooling, and your cooling process won't occur quickly at that point. So you do want to lose a lot of that heat before it ever goes into the refrigerator.
Hopefully everybody listening to this realizes they should do that at home, too, because I never knew that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think all the things that Mom used to do when we were little don't apply today. We're going to get you perfect yanked.
Mike told me about hard-boiled eggs, because like my process of hard-boiling eggs is not what you should do. So don't eat any of mine because.
Okay. You were quick to feed me on May 3rd, too.
Well, you were saying the hard boiled eggs because we were talking about the process of the best way for the skin not to stick is to boil them and then to give it an ice bath and then to like put it in your refrigerator. Mm-hmm. But you were talking about how if you put it in the refrigerator, if you put the eggs in the refrigerator while still really hot, it could change the temperature of your refrigerator with your other food.
Could heat the refrigerator up. And then things that were already cold won't be cold anymore, and anything you were trying to cool isn't capable of cooling down.
Yeah,
a lot of dense foods will do that because they retain that heat for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you cook a large pot, you know, a few gallon pot of whatever, like a dense chili or a soup, and you just take that entire pot, even at 135 degrees, even if you were waiting to get to that danger zone, and then you go to put it in the refrigerator, and you think you're doing the right thing, if it's too thick, or if it's too dense, or it's too much, and you don't do anything like add ice or put an ice wand or stir it or anything like that, you can come back 24 hours later, and it still won't be down to 70, 50.
Wow.
It won't drop temperature. That's why you need, like Mike said, break it down into smaller portions. And we usually go on a general rule of if it's like a liquid of some kind, no greater than 2 or 3 inches. deep. So you want to put in these like hotel pans of no, so you put it in 2 or 3 inches deep, and plus it increases the surface area. The idea of get all that heat to escape. Right. But you definitely don't want to put a, you know, a few gallon pot of soup in the refrigerator. It will never cool down in time.
Right. Well, we know that the way we.
Yeah.
So new alert. We love one of our members in the Lions Club loves making well chili and soup.
Yeah. And 10 gallons at a time.
Yeah.
So we'll keep it overnight. He cooks it in the morning, and then we'll take it down to the large refrigerator at the club.
The walk-in.
No, it's the same size. But that's the only thing in it, other than maybe some sodas, but. By that time, it's generally pretty cool, mm-hmm. and so we'll leave it in there, you know, overnight until the event the next day.
That would be safe if it were 3 inches in depth or less.
So we should.
If it were 6 inches or greater, it won't cool down. So in 6 hours.
So for now on, he's got to make it fresh that day.
The easiest way to handle that is to have it be fresh from the day of, because again, the hot holding is a lot easier to accomplish than cooling. Cooling is a pretty difficult process. Mm-hmm. You can take two sticks, go out in the woods and rub two sticks together, and if you know what you're doing and you're persistent, you can create heat and start a fire, but you'll never get a refrigerator working like that out in the woods.
I guess,
it's a very difficult process. Yeah.
That would be kind of hard.
Yeah.
I guess, too, it would make more sense to break it down into separate containers, because if you take that big container out and reheat it, and don't finish it all, you don't want to cool it back down again, do you? I mean, that could be dangerous,
too. A second time, you're saying?
Yeah.
A second time. If each one of those steps were done adequately, it would still be safe.
Really?
Yeah, it'd still be safe.
You would just have to repeat it each time you want to cool it down. There technically is no limit to how many times you can heat and cool things down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the quality of your food might go down, but that's not any of our concern. It's the safety.
Safety.
So you could reheat it just fine, but...
I'm a stickler on that, because one thing I hate is, well, number one, I believe in eating leftovers.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell my wife, if she takes something out and reheats it and don't finish eating it all, I'll throw it. Just throw it away. You already reheated it once. You don't want to reheat it again. But now you're telling me I could, so... Yeah,
if you
I
didn't,
have to do
if
as
you
much
didn't
cooking
abuse it, if you didn't abuse the temperature between reheating it or putting, if you took out a thing of chili that was previously cooked the day before and you heated it up, but you didn't finish it,
right?
If that chili didn't sit out for too long, and you can certainly cool it again and reheat it the next day and cool it again.
Even if you reheat it in the microwave.
Yeah, no, it doesn't matter the heat source. And, as long as you get that entire thing heated up to 165 degrees.
Is the reheating temperature. So
right.
Second time heats or reheats are, in general, hotter than the first time cooked temperatures required. Most foods are considered to be adequately cooked their first time at 145, but all of them need to be 165 within only 2 hours for a reheat, meaning the second time that food was brought up to, I guess, heating temperature. It needs to go higher the second time.
Yeah.
And it needs to happen quickly. You got a time limit. If cooking it the first time, you could slow cook your pork or your beef
right.
for a day or a day and a half, and it would be okay. But not the reheat, not the second time it's brought up to temperature. It's 2 hours or less.
Okay, you told me that, too, because I don't know.
Because bacteria are always in competition with one another, and when you cook that food the first time, you've eliminated a large percentage of various species of bacteria.
Right.
And when that food cools back down, those that didn't get completely eliminated with that first cook now have unfettered access to the remaining food. And so that's why that reheat is going to, and the cooling is a lot more important, or just as important as that first time cook, because it favors those that didn't get eliminated on that first time cook.
Huh.
And so they don't have to compete with all the others that were there initially anymore.
Now, storing food as well. I mean, there's, like, whether you're storing in the walk-in or whatever, there's certain levels where you should store it as well, right?
There's a hierarchy of what types of food you store where. Right. It goes by cook temperature, the initial cook temperature.
Okay.
So the foods that require the greatest cook temperature, like your poultry, your turkey, that requires 165 degrees. It takes a lot of heat to cook that and to kill the bacteria that is normally associated with those types of foods. Mm-hmm. Those are stored at the bottom. And then it goes by 10-degree increments based on the type of food. So poultry and your feathered animals are at the bottom, 165. Then you jump up to 155. You can have on the next shelf up.
Right.
Your ground beef, all your ground foods, ground fish, anything that's combined together. Then you're going to get into your whole muscle, like your steak, whole fish, things like that will be at 145. The next level up is 135, which would be your vegetables or pre-cooked foods. And that's because if anything on a shelf above it were to drip down on the shelf below it, whatever drips down on that one, you're going to cook it to a higher temperature than the one above it anyway. So if you had a piece of bloody steak that might have been dripping down, a whole muscle steak dripping down onto, let's say, a piece of chicken. Oh. Well, no, not a cake. But if it were to drip down onto a chicken, you're not going to cook that chicken to only 145 like you would for the steak. You're going to cook it to 165. So you're eliminating the potential of that cross-contamination, which is why you don't want to store cake underneath chicken.
You want that at the top.
Because you're not going to cook that.
Well, I bring that up because, and I never knew that. When I worked at a restaurant that's no longer in business, good figure. one of the things I never knew about that. And I remember the owner coming in yelling at somebody because they had put a cake on the bottom, actually below the chicken, and say, throw it away.
Well, that's a good owner. I mean, they did
the right thing.
They did the right thing. And
well, that was one of the things they did.
So, yeah, I mean, that's like you said, that there is a rhyme or reason why we are, you know, particular about how they store things.
Right.
Because things will drip. I mean, it's not perfect. Yeah. So if they were to drip, whatever was contaminated hopefully will be cooked to the proper temperature, eliminating any of the bacteria that came from the shelf above it. That's the idea.
Well, you buy fresh meat, fresh poultry, whatever. Bring it home or bring it to the restaurant. How long can you put it in the refrigerator for, or should you freeze it right away? I mean, I don't know if you guys can answer that or not, because I know, like, a lot of times I'll bring roast home and I'll just put it on the bottom shelf in the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I want to cook it the next day.
Well,
freezing it wise.
If you're talking about raw,
raw meat.
So maybe Mike can correct me if I'm misspoken, but in our regulation, we don't determine how long something can be in the fridge for. We will determine if it has like a foul smell or if it appears to be spoiled. We'll observe it visually, and if we happen to smell it and smell spoiled, if the food is adulterated, we will, you know, tell them to discard that. But there's nothing that says in our regulation that, okay, you get a fresh piece of chicken from your vendor, you can only hold it for X number of days. You can freeze it for quite a long time.
Right.
That will preserve it for a very long time in the refrigerator. You know, there's not a specific number of days. Because different vendors might have held it for a longer time than another vendor before you actually get it. So restaurant A might receive their chicken from this vendor, and they might have gotten it maybe a day after it was butchered, let's just say. But another vendor might have sent it 3 days after it was butchered. But when they get it, there's no specific time frame of how long they can hold it. They have to visually observe to see whether or not that piece of meat is spoiled and if it's still good or viable.
Okay.
I don't know if you have any other way to determine.
I guess the federal foods folks, the FDA,
right?
I think they recommend 3 to 4 days maximum for raw meats like that. And then things that are cooked, maybe 7 days at the longest after they've cooked.
Wow.
Again, quality can suffer. It's going to diminish throughout those periods. But I think those are outside maximums.
Okay.
3 to 4 days for something that is raw and hasn't been cooked, a meat item or poultry, and no more than 7 for things that have been cooked.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, let's say I just come to the county. I want to open up a restaurant.
Right.
How long is the process between plan review and everything
saying the building's already done, but how long is the process before I can actually open up?
Okay, so that is the division that I'm a part
right.
of. So what we do, the straight answer is there really is no right answer how
okay.
long. There's no definitive number of days that we have to get the project open. It's all dependent on the contractors, the applicants. If you're going into a facility and the building is already there, you're going into an empty tenant spot.
Right.
And if you don't require a building permit, if you're going into a place that used to be a food facility and you don't have to do any structural changes and you don't need a building permit, we wouldn't require any architecturally stamped plans or anything official as far as building permits or plans. We would need some sort of a documented plan, whether you can draw it on graph paper or you're good with a computer. We would need something that shows what you want to do.
Right.
And you would show us what equipment you want to put in there. And since there's no building permit that needs to be applied for or signed off on, it could be as quick as however long it takes you to get those plans together. We do a first in, first out review process. So, you know, it might be a few days before we get to actually look at your plan. But in general, I mean, it's relatively quick. You know, we never give an exact time, but I'd say for that scenario, within a week, we would have a word back to you saying whether or not we need you to make changes back and forth. And then when you make those changes, we say, okay, go ahead and build out your restaurant. And now that whole thing changes if you're going into a brand new place where there's lots of things that need to be altered. New plumbing, new fixtures, and all that kind of stuff. So there's no exact number of days of how long it takes. It depends. It's scenario based.
Okay.
Depends if there's a permit that needs to be pulled,
right.
how many things you're actually changing. Now, if you were going into an existing place that was a restaurant and maybe it had just recently closed, and you just want to go in and reopen it. Say there was a diner and it was in operation and for whatever reason they closed, but all the equipment is still there. And there's no structural things that need to be taken care of. They just went out of business for whatever reason. You want to go in and reopen it as is. Same equipment, same stuff. That would fall under what we call a change of ownership. If it was recently closed and it hadn't been shut down for too long. At that point, there is no plan review. We would just go with you to the facility and inspect every square inch of that place and give you a list of items that need to be corrected or brought up to par and up to code with our current standard. We leave you with that list, and however long it takes you to get that list corrected is however long it's going to take you to open.
Okay.
So it could take you a day, it could take you 6 months. So it all depends on how the shape of that facility. There's places that just recently closed, and somebody might go in there and they want to reopen it. We might have on record that place was already, you know, in good compliance.
Right.
We go in there. There might be a few things that need to change. They might be able to open by the end of the next day. You know,
wow.
It all depends on the shape of the facility you're trying to take over.
Okay.
So that would be a change of ownership.
Is this the same for food trucks or similar process?
It could be similar.
Yeah.
All the stuff that we're talking about related to brick and mortar places would still fall under for food trucks. So if you had a food truck and you didn't want to operate it anymore, you sold it to your brother-in-law, he would have to then go through a change of ownership process. We would inspect the truck. If there were any regulation changes from the time that you had it to the time he's taken it over, we'd make sure that those updates have been made on the truck, and then we would follow the same procedure. We'd inspect it, leave him with a list. And then,
so there's no grandfathering of any.
I don't know if the term grandfather really exists, but there are some things that places do get away from, and they're not normally our say at the health department, but there are certain jurisdictions within the county that do allow certain things to not be brought up to code. Not necessarily code, but for example, there's in Havity Grace, it's a historical city.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the buildings can't be manipulated. So they may not have wheelchair access. They might not have
right.
ADA compliance. They might not have a bathroom that has 25 square feet of radial turn for a wheelchair. They're not going to ask to change out all of this stuff for a historical building. So the city of Havity Grace, as an example, might say, we will not make you include those changes on your plan review. But a place that wants to go in brand new, a brand new building, we would require
right.
all of those. Now, some of that stuff I just mentioned is more on the building department, but one example that we would say that we would ask for is a grease interceptor. There are some areas and jurisdictions in Harford County that won't require it. For example, in downtown Havity Grace, where it is a historical area, where it's nearly impossible to physically install a grease interceptor. We normally require those in new restaurants or if you're making major renovations. Mm-hmm. But they have determined that they didn't want to keep restaurants from opening because they couldn't put in a grease interceptor. So they have been not installing them. Wow. So that's sort of your grandfather remark. That's sort of right. One example.
Okay, I thought you were getting ready to ask something.
Nope, I think you answered it.
with the food trucks, I guess, I don't know, are the inspections actually tougher? Yeah. Thinking of truffles.
Yeah.
Tougher on the food trucks, and the reason I'm asking that is because, like, with emissions and everything.
Well, that's not our say. So they do have to have proper registration, licensing, and inspections and everything through the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Right.
They have to. They'll show us that they have an updated registration and all that stuff. But as far as the truck, the engine, and the emissions and the mechanical part of the truck, we are hands off. We do send the truck to the electrical department before they even come to us. So they have to get all the electrical workings inspected, the electrical panel that runs all the equipment that is plugged into the truck. Mm-hmm. They also have a switch that can switch from generator use to if they want to plug the truck into an actual outlet.
Right.
So all the electrical stuff, we outsource that to the electrical department. They're the experts, so they inspect. And then they keep going back for inspections until they pass the electrical department.
Okay.
Once the electrical department says that, you know, that we approve them, then they come through us to do the food handling and the food equipment inspections. But they before they do any of that, all of the motor vehicle stuff should have been taken care of before they're even on the road to drive it.
I guess you're seeing more and more food trucks pop up around here.
We see a lot. When I started here about 7.5 years ago, we had... Not counting the Schwann's, which is like the
delivery. Right, yeah,
they just have the frozen ones. But actual food trucks that are cooking and everything, we probably had like, I think like 11 or so. And we have like close to 30 plus food trucks that are actually cooking.
In the county?
Yeah.
Interesting. I never see any.
The reason why you probably don't see a lot is a lot of them get licensed in this county because they want to participate in a lot of the bigger events. So you'll see them at the events, but you won't necessarily see them driving around because Harford County, they're set up different than like Baltimore. Baltimore has a lot more foot traffic in so many more areas.
Yeah.
But Harford County, you go to a site, you know, you're not going to get the foot traffic. So a lot of them get licensed here, but they end up traveling down to Baltimore, specifically into the city, or a lot of them work down in Washington, D.C. A lot of our trucks are also licensed in D.C. Mm. If you've ever been down there, it's the entire street is completely flooded.
Right.
You can get every kind of food from every country in the world from one truck to the next.
Wild, actually.
Yeah, so a lot of our trucks do go down there. But they get licensed up here because once they're licensed here, they can operate at festivals and fairs and sporting events. And if they want to go to a nearby construction site to serve lunch for those days, they can do that without getting any additional licenses.
So they don't have to get licensed in each county?
They do have to get licensed in each county.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, that's a new proposal that went through for the mobile units is a reciprocity license. So once you get licensed in a home county, whatever that home county may be, wherever your commissary is, you can then subsequently get licensed in every other county, and you don't have to come through my division or the Division of Plan Review to get licensed. You just hand in all of your documents from the previous county that licensed you, and we say, okay, you're licensed. And we never even see the truck.
Wow.
We are hoping that the previous county that licensed them did all the right steps in licensing them. Now, we will still send them to Harford County Electrical Services to get inspected if the previous county didn't have that demand or that requirement, or we'll send them to Mr. Bill Giles with the fire marshal.
Mm-hmm.
He'll have to inspect their hood system for the fire suppression. There are still some discrepancies on how the mobile units are handled. Some counties are doing them a little differently than others.
Mm-hmm.
There's still an effort to standardize that process. I'd say Harford County is probably the more stricter you know, more appropriate inspection process. We kind of cover everything. Where there are other counties that are still not requiring certain things, we require everything.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, what you're seeing, another thing you're seeing pop up a lot are breweries. Now, and with food and everything, you're selling food. But do they have to put together, what do they call it, vats or whatever? Mm-hmm. Does that go through you?
If they're just a brewery, no, we don't license just a brewery.
Okay. But if they're serving food.
If they're serving food, we'll strictly look at just the food service.
The food.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, if there's a brewery and they have an on-site brewery system with all of their containers and, you know, they're putting all the ingredients together, that's a separate entity.
So
there's another, other agencies, I'm not quite who they are, but they will inspect and license that division.
Okay.
But if they are doing on-site food service, we will inspect that particular area. We'll exclude the beer processing.
I guess that's why you're seeing some of them will just have a food truck there now.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there's a lot of discrepancy. I'm pretty sure when you have a liquor license, some of the requirements are that you have to serve food in some capacity. Now, that has changed over the years. It used to be like open food of some kind, but now I think they're getting away with just having like even snacks like pretzels or chips. But they still want to serve food to the public, so they'll hire mobile units to kind of sit outside for people to go.
Because I know, years ago we used to have a restaurant nightclub, and I know we had to sell a certain amount of food for the liquor part, not the beer part, but the hard liquor part. You had to sell a certain amount of food for. Of course, that was several years ago. You probably weren't even born yet, Justin, so I'm sure that's probably changed by now. You know, but now, all right, so somebody calls up Molly, or they call Molly with a food complaint.
Mm-hmm.
How quick do you have to get out there and inspect it? Because, somebody could see it online complaining, and all of a sudden it's gone.
It depends on what type of complaint it is.
Okay.
If it's just foodborne, if it is foodborne illness, I think we run a 3-day maximum interval, to go out and investigate the complaint. Mm-hmm. And if it's just regarding food handling, no one claims they've gotten sick, they complain about how food's handled in the facility, then that would be five days.
What about rodents?
That would be a condition in the facility, 5 days.
Okay.
Food handling or conditions in the facility.
Okay.
Not which, I guess, generated illness.
So you go in, if they fail the inspection, then they're shut down for what?
Until they can resolve the issues.
Okay. So
critical violations cause a facility to be closed. If they have any critical violations that they cannot resolve immediately, they have to close down until they can resolve all critical violations.
Do you have a process for weeding through complaints, or do you have to address everyone? Or,
well, for me, I like best practices to just address everyone.
And you can kind of, after doing it for a long period of time, you can kind of tell what's genuine and what is. Somebody just doesn't like a restaurant, so they're going to complain about it.
I think for the most part, everybody's like pretty genuine with their complaints for really any kind of complaint they submit through the website. A lot of things I can just handle myself and just kind of respond, but other things like food complaints, and I'll just forward on the appropriate staff member. A lot of times we'll get, like if somebody gets ill from a restaurant, they'll submit a complaint, and then say it's like a large party, so there's like 20 people at their table.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have like all 20 people email through the website. So then you just have to. Does that count as one infraction for the restaurant, or would you count that as 20 different
20 complaints?
20 complaints,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just forward, you know, those 20 emails to them,
right?
And just say, you have a lot of emails coming soon. We just had one last week.
How does that work with, like we were talking about earlier, the temporary food license? Mm-hmm. How does that work with the license? I mean, you can't really shut them down if it's only a one-day event.
Yeah.
How's what work with
it? In other words, if there's a a complaint, mm-hmm. whether they handled the food wrong or somebody got sick, mm-hmm. and they had a temporary license. So, you know, you get the report, but the event's already over.
Yeah, so.
So, I mean, would they get a fine or something? I mean.
Precious little to investigate at that point in time.
Okay.
So you would have to follow up, but as you're noting, it would be no physical evidence in mostly all cases. Nothing to verify, confirm, or exclude the possibility that it happened.
Okay.
So you would need to discuss that, of course, with the operator, just like a permit facility, and ask them about it, and go from their responses. Oftentimes we get complaints that have photographs included. So something like that would be some evidence
right.
that a certain thing occurred.
And we've had, and I won't name any names or anything, but we've had complaints for temporary food vendors along with video clips. Everyone has a phone now. So when they're out doing festivals and stuff, we've actually had videos of mishandled food at a food vendor or at a food event. So we know the infraction, we know what the problem was, and we also know who did it because it's on video
right.
for them actually doing it. That will weigh heavily on us allowing them to operate again. So we can't shut them down because they don't have a license, but if they were to apply to do another event, we will think twice about it and say, well, you have a history of doing this, or however we will handle it at that time. It will weigh heavily on our because when you apply, that's what you're doing. You're applying. It doesn't mean you're actually going to get one. We have to do a phone interview to talk about what food handling processes you're going to do and how you're going to do it, if you're going to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
We explain to them. We have the we talked earlier before we started this, we have a temporary food setup YouTube video that kind of explains how to set it up properly and what the right steps are. But if we have on record that we have complaints about your operation in the past along with a video proof, we have all the right to either deny it or heavily, you know, watch over them, you know, inspect them, maybe come back in the afternoon for a follow-up inspection.
Okay.
So there it will, although we can't close them down for that prior complaint, when they go to reapply for another event down the road, that's when it'll hurt them.
Have you guys, and I don't know if you do this or not, and if not, have you thought about it? You know, are if with events or restaurants, whatever, that serve liquor, you have to have somebody which is tip certified. With the food, you know, whether it be restaurant or temporary, is there like a food safety course that the people have to take? Or have you guys even thought about maybe making that a mandatory thing? Maybe a good idea.
Well, there is, and I'll let Mike talk about that.
Well, it's not required. The Maryland State Legislature has, I guess, looked into that many times in the past. But at this point in time, there's not a statewide requirement for food service or food handling certification. Some counties, I don't know if Baltimore County has it, do have that requirement in their local code,
right?
But not statewide. However, there are courses available for food handlers to get certification. It's just not required in Harford County because there's not a statewide requirement for that.
Have you ever seen a day where it is mandatory? Or do you hope it will become mandatory?
We don't see much improvement for the people that claim to have the certification versus those that don't.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's always, although, like Mike said, although we don't, if we looked at all the restaurants and we categorized ones that have a ServSafe manager certification or people on staff that were certified for proper food handling, we looked at the group that didn't have it, he's right. There usually is not a distinction in, you know, okay, these people know what they're doing because they're certified. They hardly have any violations, and these people don't. There isn't, but I would still say that it's better to at least have those folks at least go through a course at least once in there, so that they can sort of be cognizant of, okay, food handling really is important. I mean, 5,000 people a year die from foodborne illnesses, so it is important. So even if it changed one or two restaurants to better themselves, to wash your hands after going to the bathroom, or, you know, don't cross contaminate or follow this. I mean, it's always better to inform them and let them make the mistake than to not require the certification to begin with. So although there's not a huge difference, I think if you start to require it, I think it'll just play on their mind and
increase awareness.
Yeah, it'll help increase awareness.
Well, and the reason I bring that up too, because like I said, when I worked at the one restaurant, you know, I was back there cooking. But when they hired me, of course, they teach you all the different things there. Thank God, because one of the things I never even thought about, different cutting boards. Mm-hmm. You know, like you have one strictly for poultry, one strictly for seafood.
They usually color.
Never thought about that.
Different colored tongs.
Yeah, I would have just, you know, all right, I'm cutting my meat on this. Let's go back, wash it. Now let's do the chicken.
Well, they even sell that for your house now.
Yeah,
different color cutting boards.
Yeah, no, I've tried to get them, but I was told no. So I don't need any more gadgets.
But all those little things are really good for food handling. I mean, they do make a difference. But again, the people have to follow it. You can have produce cutting boards and meat cutting boards, but people could still be lazy and just grab the produce one that they just cut meat with. So it all goes back to, I mean, really hiring people who care or to do the right thing. Because you can have all the training or the ServSafe certifications, but if the staff is just... If you have someone who's lazy who doesn't want to take the extra step,
that's true.
To wash their hands in between a certain task, or to properly change out their gloves, or to break down this chili to cool it properly, they're going to just skip those steps.
You just mentioned something, gloves.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize this too. Apparently, there's certain types of gloves, like was it latex you're not supposed to use, or something with powder. You're not supposed to use?
Well, I don't. We don't regulate the type of glove.
Okay.
I mean, as long as it's a food safe glove, like you can't use gloves that you would go welding with. But it has to be a.
It has to be some tough food.
You'd be surprised. I mean, if you give anybody any kind of just blank statement of using gloves, they will just find a pair of gloves that they just change their tire with. I'm wearing gloves. You didn't say what kind of glove. So it does have to be a food safe glove.
Okay.
Typically, they're latex or vinyl or plastic or something. There are people who are allergic to latex, so most food places will not order those because you don't want to make someone's food and then they're allergic to latex and so on and so forth. So most the powder ones, I personally like those because in a proper way to use gloves is you have to wash your hands just prior to putting the gloves on.
Right.
So you wash your hands and then you go to put gloves on. And if you don't entirely dry your hands with the disposable towel, and there might be a little bit of moisture on your hand, they're hard to get on. So the ones with powder are easier to get on, more inclined for people to actually use the gloves. Mm-hmm. If they're a pain to get on, they're going to the heck with it, and they might not wash their hands. They'll just put the gloves on because their hands are dry. So if you have gloves that are good and easy to put on, they will be more inclined to actually wear them.
Mm-hmm. So the powder's inside the gloves. It's not going to seep through, I guess.
Even if it did, I think the manufacturer is making where it's safe. I mean, they are meant for food. They're usually NSF certified or ETL sanitary. A lot of different third-party agencies that certify these food handling gloves and utensils. But like I said, you can't just go and grab any pair of gloves to do it.
Got my winter gloves on them. I just made a snowball with it earlier.
Well,
okay.
I mean, it's funny, but there are certain gloves that are like cut-proof. They're cloth and they have the steel ridges on there so you don't cut your fingers. Well, we've seen people in food service establishments trying to use those gloves to now like handle, to continue on. So maybe they're cutting, you know, big frozen pieces of lamb or chicken or something so they don't get cut. And those gloves should be properly washed and sanitized, but they can't go and start mixing salad with those gloves.
I mean,
you really got to be careful with the style of gloves.
With the plastic gloves on over top of them.
I've
seen people do that, though. I mean, you can. If you're cutting the meat, you know, because it's almost like a chain mall glove.
Right.
You know, put a plastic glove over top if you're going to be touching that meat. For some chain mall things.
Yeah, but that's hard to bend your fingers.
Well, it's not an actual chain.
No, I know. I used one before. I'm just saying. Oh. Like, they're just, it's, I can't imagine.
You don't have the dexterity.
What'd you say?
They don't have the dexterity.
Right. Like I just can't imagine being able to do anything else besides, like, hold something.
If anything.
Yeah.
And that would be a practice that wouldn't be approved because you didn't wash your hands before you put on those gloves. So the chainmail glove would need to come off and stay off.
Right.
Wash your hands, now put on the disposable glove. So the thought or the idea of putting on both would be outside regulatory requirements too.
Like I said, I wouldn't do that.
Do you want to talk really quickly about people who cook or bake out of their home with intention to sell?
Yeah, this is one of my questions.
There's a category called the cottage food industry, cottage food food requirements. And I can say using cottage to indicate a small or startup or very small base operations. They are limited to sales of not greater than $25,000 per year. And initially, they were supposed to only allow for eligibility foods that are what Justin had mentioned earlier, non-potentially hazardous foods.
Okay.
And those are foods that don't support the rapid bacterial growth of pathogenic bacteria. So things like granola, cereal, baked goods like cookies or standard cakes, not to include cheesecakes because they need refrigeration, is our belief, and things like custard-based pies, like right. pumpkin pie or sweet potato pie. They generally have custards in their formulations, so those things, even though Grandma didn't put them in the refrigerator after she made them, it stayed out on the counter for however long they wanted to be out. They should be refrigerated. Okay. So those things weren't eligible. But that's slowly starting to be modified. At any rate, these people with those non-potentially hazardous foods can prepare them in a home kitchen, and then bring them out to the public. Initially, it was limited to just farmers markets would be one place you could sell those goods, and in other public events like a fair or a carnival or a big exhibition show, sporting event, etc. That's starting to be modified, and those goods can be, I guess, dispensed in greater and more allowance, more acceptance. They can now sell them directly from their homes to individuals.
Really?
They can sell them mail order to individuals now. And they even most recently opted to include retail facilities. So they can sell them to Giant Supermarket and Weis Markets and whatever, wherever else they would like to. On the cottage foods, they have to have a statement. They have to be labeled.
Right.
And they have to list the ingredients in condescending, in descending order. Not condescending.
That's typical. <Yeah. laughs>
In descending order, according with their promise in the product. And they have to have a label that says something to the effect of made by a cottage food vendor, not subject to Merlin's food safety regulations, or not subject to food safety regulations. So that the individual that buys them and consumes them would be aware that it's not an inspected operation that created those foods. So that is another requirement. Each unit has to be labeled at the place of manufacturer. And they can't ever have them open. They have to be fully sealed, created with sealing the label back where it was manufactured. But they also have no contact at all with local health departments or the state health department in regards to having their facility or their operation evaluated. So if food's made in a home kitchen and brought out and dispensed to the public, those are cottage food.
Okay. And that applies across the board. For example, if our Leo group, the teenage group, wants to sell cookies in an event, they need to be wrapped, labeled. They can't be laid out on a tray in the open.
Right. Each one has to be completely labeled. The regulations will say what size font is required, and the fact that label, the letters, the characters have to be in contrast with the background label. You can't put yellow letters on a yellow sheet of paper or that kind of thing. But, yeah, just about any facility.
Just the ingredients and what it's made with now, especially because of allergies.
Any allergens have to be stated as well.
So, if bad, the only place you really can't sell them, then I guess would be the school still. Because I'd better.
I mean, the schools are a licensed establishment. We license the school kitchens.
No, I mean, like if we made it at home and hadn't invented the school. This is what we were told a while ago. That you're not allowed to sell baked goods at a school event unless you buy it from a store.
No, we allow bake sales. No.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know I'm going to be.
And most of those bake sales would fall under like a temporary. I mean, if you wanted to package it under a cottage food, they would be able to do that. But if they wanted to apply for a bake sale.
Well, you mean the school itself wanting to sell those things?
No. In other words, like there's. Some schools hold events, whether it be a field day or whatever, and they ask for vendors to come in. And, you know, we had, I forget who it was, but they wanted to go in and sell some cookies that they made at home. And they were told they're not allowed to because it's against regulation, health regulation. You cannot sell anything you make at home at the school.
It
has to be bought at a store.
The school's operation, if the cookies were created by the school in there, I guess staff or affiliates would be okay. But in the past, those things could not be cooked by John Taylor and brought into the school and the school sell them out. The school could create it, you know, that them as an organization, a nonprofit organization, selling non-potentially hazardous goods was another way foods could be prepared in a home kitchen and doled out to the public. Cottage food is a different way that things could be done at a home kitchen and doled out to the public. And for the case of those baked goods, they couldn't be done in, I guess, all of those private homes and then be sold and labeled and done under the auspice of being Youth Benefits Elementary School, because Youth Benefit didn't create those. They're just the ones that are selling them. So, however, it could be a bake sale, and those things created by Youth Benefit staff as an organization could be then dispensed to the public.
Okay.
Just couldn't. Each individual student couldn't make them at home at their own homes, and then I guess try to dispense them as being a Youth Benefit.
They would have to actually cottage food label them. In every single individual one. Okay. You can put them in bulks of a dozen, and then that dozen would have to be packaged and labeled. But if they would make them and set them out, you couldn't do that under the cottage food. And then the one other thing, too, with the cottage food is it has to be within the state. So if I was a cottage food person and I was making chocolate chip cookies at home, I couldn't sell it to places in Pennsylvania or Delaware or New Jersey.
At the Pennsylvania Dutch market.
All the sales have to be done within the state of Maryland. I don't know how they regulate that with these internet sales.
Right.
If they're being honest and they're following the rules, they're probably not supposed to mail them across state lines. Like if you had somebody buy them from California and you're going to mail your cookies with a Maryland cottage food label,
right.
I don't think you can do that. I don't know how it's followed. I don't know how they regulate that, but that's you can't sell it outside of Maryland.
I was going to say, that'd be kind of tough, you know. So,
to regulate.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Everyone has their own opinion on cottage food. I'm not a huge fan because of the direction it's going. Like Mike said, it's starting to open it up to potentially hazardous foods, which now we're starting to get away from real public health. And you start letting people make potentially hazardous foods, not cookies and cake, but now you're going to let them make, you know, things that do require refrigeration, you're going to sell them to the public without having their kitchen inspected or using home-style equipment.
Yeah.
Then you're getting into a dangerous area of Molly's inbox is going to be flooded with outbreaks of people getting sick from eating really bad food.
Pet hairs.
Yeah, you got people at home, pets lizards. Climbing on the counters. And
lizards.
Lizards, what?
People have all kinds of pets in their homes. You know, so all of these things are in their homes. Yeah. So those things will get accidentally.
This is my lizard. Can somebody search their cake?
I had a
a lizard once, and I was like terrified. I never touched it, and it was gone like the next day. It's like,
did you bake anything the next day?
I was little. Yeah.
But that's starting to teeter into an area that I know we're not comfortable right. with. It's not. You're getting away from real public health. It's not.
Very
unsafe. It's not how it's intended. We made it this far, and we've started to regulate because we've learned by basic science and temperature and control and all these things, and now we're going to go backwards? For what reason? We don't know.
Well, not only that, with some of the stuff they're legalizing now, you never know what could be added.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've gotten a few people asking me about, like, this CBD oil and what the requirements are. Can we put it in food? And it's so new, I don't have information on that. You know, there's a lot of information that we're got to seek out, you know.
Getting kind of scary now. Mm-hmm. Man.
But if you're buying food and it's from a non-licensed place, you're taking that risk yourself.
Yeah.
And that's kind of goes back to that whole label. This food was not manufactured, it was manufactured in an unlicensed kitchen, not regulated by any health department, state, local. So you're taking
regulated
that
by my wife's health department. Did you come to stay for? Oh, shut up!
Oh, and you had mentioned something earlier about the mobile units.
Yes.
And you mentioned how restaurants have restrooms, and mobile units wouldn't. And I just wanted to say that restaurants only are required to have those restrooms if they provide dining.
Right.
So if the place is walk up or carry out only, they don't need to provide a restroom.
Not for the public.
Right.
They would still need a restroom for the employees.
The plumbing board would require them to not have a facility that's an open and operating business and not provide a restroom for the staff, for the employees. It wouldn't be a health department thing, but ours comes in wherein they have seating or not. That's when the health department require you to have a restaurant.
I mean, a restaurant. How would that work if, let's say, I have a food truck and I pull up, but then I set out picnic tables?
That'd be illegal. You'd be doing something illegal.
Like I said, I wouldn't do that, but I'm saying this.
Now, if you parked your mobile unit in a park that already had picnic tables and things, and they weren't yours, and you weren't purposely providing those seats.
So it's not considered.
That's not your. Okay. Those aren't your seats. But if you're setting out a little tent and a little table and seats, and you're providing seats for them, you have a legitimate health department license. You shouldn't be providing seats.
Okay.
They need to find those seats on.
Because it may not have been here. It may have been in another county, but I remember seeing stuff like that. You know, people. You know,
mobile truck, food truck.
Yeah, they'll set up a tent. Now, it may have been just them sitting under the tent waiting for customers. I don't know.
Okay.
But it looked like they had, you know, picnic table there. That's all I was wondering about. That's like, something ain't right there.
Well, yeah, like Mike said, if we, all of our restaurants or any place that we license, with the exception of a mobile unit, they do have to have at least one restroom provided to the employees. If there's any seats that are provided to the public to come in and sit down and dine, then you have to have a certain number of restrooms based on the number of seats.
Okay.
And that's determined by the plumbing department. If you have 15 or less seats, you only require to have one public restroom. And that same public restroom can be used by the employees. So essentially you could just have one bathroom in your facility.
In a good location. Right. It couldn't be through the kitchen. The public can't come through the kitchen to get to it.
Okay.
It has to be accessible without going through the kitchen.
Right. So if you had a bathroom in the back, you couldn't have the public just walk through your kitchen to get to that bathroom. We would not count that bathroom as a public restroom.
So if certain amount of seats can only have, you could, one public, let me see if I'm getting this wrong.
If you have 15 seats or less you only need to provide one bathroom. You can have as many bathrooms.
So it could be a unisex family, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It has to have one, at least one bathroom. If you have more than 15 seats, you have to provide at least two public restrooms.
Okay. Interesting. I didn't know that. I thought you always had to have like a men and a ladies' bathroom.
Mm-hmm. Canned goods at events or even in the restaurants, how is that regulated? Or second part of that question is, I do a lot of canning. Can I sell that at a Lions event that we put on?
Well, there's sort of like a two-part question. When it regarding the sale, or if you're going to make that as part of a cottage food process, I don't know if home canning is one of the approved, but if your final product was determined by like a scientific food lab to be considered non-potentially hazardous, whether the water activity or the pH is at a certain level, if that final product was canned and it was considered to be non-potentially hazardous, I think you would be able to get away with then selling it like another non-potentially hazardous food. But I think canning, though, I think that falls under a special process. And there we have a list of the foods that are approved for the cottage food. I can't remember if it lists whether or not canning, the process of canning, would fall under there. But I'd have to get back to you about that one. Unless, Mike, if you have any insight on canning.
Well, and certain canned foods are allowed. Home canned foods are allowed at a farmer's market and with this cottage food regulation.
Okay.
And those are things of high acid capacity. The pH is very low. And those fruits are listed. If there are other things that are considered low acid foods, like maybe string beans or something like that, they wouldn't be allowed for you to create at home. But things like grape jelly, maybe strawberry jam, those we have a list of fruits that would be eligible for that. And then all the things that aren't on that would not be eligible to be canned at home and then dispensed to the public without getting a home manufacturer license. The state does allow, generally it's in conjunction with a farm, but the state does provide some home canning licenses.
Interesting. And you said list. Is the list on the website, or they'd have to contact you guys?
A link to the regulations is on our website, and within the Maryland Food Code regulations, which is 10-15-03, farmers market products are listed in there, and the same for what is eligible for cottage food license exemption is also listed in there.
Okay. So if anybody wants to get a hold of you guys for any questions or anything, what's the phone number?
Well, my direct line is 410-877-2309, and that's the Division of Plan Review. So that's including brand new restaurants, whether it's a new build, or if you want to go into an existing building that was not previously a restaurant, you're going to outfit to be a new restaurant, or if you want to take over a restaurant that maybe had just recently closed, or if you were going to buy an existing restaurant that's currently in operation, but you're going to take over as a new owner, we would also be contacted for that. If you plan on starting up your own mobile food truck, we would also be a part of that. If you're an existing restaurant and you're listening to this and you want to make extensive renovation or changes, we would also contact our office to go through the proper procedures in order to do that.
And what's the website?
www.harfordcountyhealth.com.
Facebook, Twitter. All Facebook, Twitter. And now we have a new Instagram.
Yes,
Instagram.
I saw that. Harford Health. Yes.
That's way more fun than...
the Instagram?
Yeah. Don't you think? It's harder, I think, to come up with content.
It's harder because it's more, more photo involved than anything.
Yeah.
It can be more fun. It's all depending on what you're posting too.
Yeah, it's true.
But with you guys, there's a lot you could, post on there and grab attention. Right. The key thing is people clicking the link to the website from Instagram, and a lot of people don't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because like I said, with your website, there's so much information on there that people can get, and to drive them there to get, that's the key.
That's why we have link for our website and our bio, so people can go there.
Right.
That was your idea?
Yeah, Ronnie set up our Instagram.
You
should follow us. Give me a shout out.
No, you did a good job. I was shocked when I saw that pop up. I'm like, whoa, health department's got an Instagram now. I was like, all right.
Stepping up the game.
Yeah.
Well, I figured Molly had set it up, but I was wrong.
Well, I've been wanting to do it for a while because I just felt like it was time to do something different besides Twitter and Facebook. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to reach a younger population.
And with our...
It's a good idea.
And one of our quality improvement goals, I guess, projects, was just to try and increase our social media presence and increase our social media followers. So then with Rania being here, she's really been helpful. So she has been able to help me out with a lot of
things. Now you guys are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube, right?
Yeah, we do have YouTube. That's our next goal, is to really build up our YouTube channel.
Yeah, because you guys do a lot of videos.
Not as much as we should.
Well, I keep thinking of the public health matters.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's been on my to-do list for, I don't know, a year, is to put our public health matters show on our YouTube channel.
Put it on the website, too.
It is.
Oh, it is? Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's not like in plain sight where you can see it, but
right.
We always publicize that through Facebook and Twitter, but there is a link on our website to that show.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And now, one thing on your website, I don't know if you guys do this or not. I don't think you do. You don't have a blog.
We have an HIV blog. We just started, actually.
Okay.
So, but no, not a general blog. To actually create content for a discussion. Yeah, we don't have that.
That'd be a good idea. I mean, do that and then let me know. Cross it. Mm-hmm. So it's coming up on both sites, generating more traffic.
Yeah. Yeah, we actually just started an HIV blog, I don't know, maybe like 2 or 3 weeks ago. Mm. So that's really new.
That's new.
Okay.
Yeah. So they can talk about HIV. But, yeah, not just a general blog of conversation.
We were talking the last podcast. It's still amazing how many people in the county don't realize everything that the health department does.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not surprised.
Yeah. Or even know where they're at. Well, the last one we did, the dental. I had no idea about
where was it?
All that.
Oh, yeah.
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 No idea that you guys did all that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
People in the health department don't realize all the things. Which is why, if you could come on May 3rd to help our own staff know the stuff that we're doing, that would be helpful.
I just wanted to mention that a general line for environmental health, food control, and food service facilities comes under environmental health division of the health department. And a general phone number for us is 410-877-2300. So all the questions that might not deal with Justin's plan review issues should come in through that other line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mike doesn't want to give out his personal line.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. But actually, you say that. So the website, we actually kind of redid the menu of our website. So environmental health, instead of having everything listed, and really took up a lot of space, we have it separated into two units. So it's resource protection and consumer protection.
Okay.
So click on consumer protection, right?
For food-related issues.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And resource protection would be wells and septic system related issues. Right.
Experience a treasure straight from the Caribbean. It's called Island Spice, right off I-95 at exit 77. Island Spice is beautifully decorated. Try the Rasta Pasta, Jerk Chicken, Curry Chicken, Roti, Oxtails, or Goat 2. Sit in the stylish lounge for happy hour drinks from 4 to 7 daily. Check out their complete menu at IslandSpiceJamaicaRestaurant.com or follow us on Facebook for upcoming events like reggae, karaoke, live jazz, and paint night 2.
Island Spice, make you lick your finger, man.